Well, hey there, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Cambridge Inside Out. It's been a little bit of a while here. And today is March 19th, 2026, for those that are looking at this from the future. So anyway, I just want to do a little catching up. I didn't do the program a couple weeks ago. I just had too much on my plate. Actually, I have too much on my plate now. Honestly, I still have a whole big stack of exams to grade, but I figure I should probably do a bit of this nonetheless. So anyway, let me just do it. I want to do a number of things today. First thing I want to do is just because I know the last time I did a program, I talked. It was actually episode 666. A lot of people laughed about that. The mark of the beast. Anyway, I talked a little bit about the potential revival of the Cambridge Civic Association. I don't know if it's where people are going to really pull it off, because I haven't really heard a whole lot since then. But, some of us would like to see something happen here. So there was what I thought I might do actually is just say a thing or two about something that we talked about last time, but I never quite got to this one little interesting piece here. So, all right. So again, don't want to go dwell on the Cambridge Civic Association forevermore here, but it was founded out of the Committee for Pliny and the Cambridge Taxpayers Association, one other organization back in that was around the 1930s, and eventually they consolidated and formed the Cambridge Civic Association in 1945. It lasted until approximately 2003. It never had an official end; it just sort of petered out. But I have a lot of archives, and one of the things in the archives that I found quite interesting was remarks from a woman named Ruth Romer, who was very, very actively involved in the committee to bring the Pliny Charter to Cambridge back in the late 1930s. And these are remarks delivered in October of 1980. And it was interesting how, the great grand circle of things, how even though this was from, what is that, 46 years ago, that there were actually some things in her remarks that are remarkably timely for today. All right. So I'm not going to, I mean, I do have it referenced off the page that I keep for the program, so you can feel free to read the thing in full. But I thought what I would do here is just show you a little bit of it here, and we'll sort of take it from there. So again, it was Ruth Romer at the 35th anniversary dinner of the Cambridge Civic Association back in October of 1980. And it's a very, very interesting background about the co-affiliations of people with the Cambridge League of Women Voters, as well as the Committee for Pliny. It's really very important, I think, for people to understand the role that a lot of women played in bringing city manager form of government to Cambridge. Honestly, dating back even to before they had a right to vote, prior to 1919. But anyway, it's a very, very interesting story. But I found something that was just really quite stunning. So at the very toward the very last portion of her remarks, she tells a story, and it was I'll sort of read it here. Wish I could name all the people who worked so very hard in the 30s and 40s. But there's one person in particular, Tony Colosimo, a naturalized citizen and dedicated worker for the Pliny and for good government in Cambridge. Mrs. A. Kingsley Porter of Elmwood, who made her entire third floor complete with telephones for Election Day headquarters. Anyway, so here it is. Speaking of Tony Colosimo, I can't resist telling you one of my favorite Cambridge stories. Early on one election day, I forget which year, I took handout materials to Tony's house. As I left for my next stop, I left it with Mrs. Colosimo because Tony wasn't there. I said to her, "Don't you forget to vote." "Oh," she said, "I can't vote." It seems she and Tony were married before 1922. Of course, she immediately lost her American citizenship under the then current law. Then, after 1922, her husband had become naturalized. 1922 was the year women could become citizens in their own right and no longer had to assume the status of their husbands. So when Tony became naturalized, she couldn't come back in with him. She was mad because she had been born and lived in Cambridge all her life, and her husband had been born in Italy. He could vote and she could not. I stress the fact that in the future, that is after 1922, no woman would lose her US citizenship if she married a non-citizen. I must say that later Mrs. Colosimo became a citizen again as the wife of an already citizen. All right. Now, the reason why I was focusing on that, honestly, was because of things that are being said at the national level now about revoking citizenship. And which I think would be a terrible thing, the idea of a natural born citizen. Now, who could be more of a natural born citizen than somebody who was born and raised and lived her entire life in Cambridge, Massachusetts? Yet, under the laws of the time, her citizenship was revoked because she married somebody who was a citizen of Italy. Anyway, I think that was a crazy law, but it's very, very interesting that there is precedent, which I suppose I should have known about, for citizenship actually being revoked, including from people who were born and raised in Cambridge once upon a time. So anyway, I'm not going to say a whole lot more than that, but just to highlight that a little bit here. Okay. All right. Anyway, I want to get back to some of what's been happening around Cambridge City Hall and environs over the last month since I last did a program. Actually, maybe before doing that, I think we perhaps should I would be remiss if I did not mention the rather horrifying incident we had on May 11th down at Memorial Drive. Not that it's particularly related to Cambridge civic and political things, really, but it was a pretty scary event for all those who were involved. Where this person who should never have been out in the street apparently was talking to his parole officer via cell phone, was behaving erratically, and the parole officer actually saw the weapon, like a assault rifle, within the frame. So as soon as he was off the cell phone, he contacted Boston police. And Boston police then contacted Cambridge police. The reason it was happening that way was apparently he was wearing, what they sometimes call a bracelet, basically a tracking device, because he had been released from prison not so long ago, after serving a sentence that was far too short for the crime he had committed before, which also involved shooting up at police, right? This person never should have been out at all. Anyway, he ends up at Memorial Drive. The tracker suggested he was around Kelly Road in Cambridgeport. Whether that was accurate or not is not important. So the Cambridge police race to get there. And then while they're arriving there, it comes over the radio that there's an active shooting incident happening in Memorial Drive. And two people were actually shot. And multiple vehicles were also shot up, but didn't injure people. My understanding is that the two people who took bullet wounds are one person actually was an MBTA bus driver, actually drove himself to the hospital after being shot in the head, which is kind of horrifying to think about. But I believe both people who were shot are doing all right. So thank God for that. But it was interesting for a number of reasons, some of which we'll sort of get to in a second, having to do with some of the political stuff. But lots to be said for the quality of the police work from the state police, Cambridge police. Apparently, one of the people who shot the guy—he wasn't killed, but he took a bullet or two in the leg—was actually an ex-Marine with a license to carry, who does not want to be identified, and I can understand why. Both citizenry and police in the area did a great job, honestly, and but. Boy, scary event all over the national news too. I saw it on, not just on, CCTV, but also on, Fox News, CNN. I'm surprised it didn't even make it to BBC, or maybe it even did. All right. Anyway, enough of that. So the later that day, there was a Cambridge City Council meeting, and of course there was a, information given about the incident as part of the council meeting from Acting Police Commissioner Pauline Wells. But also on the agenda for that very meeting was an order from some problematic counselors to remove the ShotSpotter technology that Cambridge has had in place for perhaps a decade or thereabouts. And then that actually was made subject of a charter right, so it didn't actually come to a vote until last night, and I was there for that. What a display, honestly. I had actually been at a public safety committee meeting in late April, where all of these DSA crazy, really, by far the most misinformed people I've encountered in my entire time in Cambridge, coupled with some of these people who they call themselves the Black Response, even though they really have nothing to do with Black people in Cambridge. But they are beloved by the little old ladies of the Cambridge Residents Alliance. Anyway, the misinformation that was being spread around there was really absolutely stunning, including this notion that this technology is recording people's conversations 24 hours a day. And then with the great concerns, of course, that data, about who's winning the Red Sox games and all that really other important stuff that we love to talk about, that was somehow going to end up in the hands of immigration officials, et cetera. I don't believe a bit of that is at all true. In fact, the way this technology works is that yes, it has to be on 100% of the time. Shocking reality. If it wasn't on, it wouldn't be functioning. But it's not recording. All it does is it basically sits there waiting until there's a sharp crack of a sound, such as a gunshot, could be a firecracker, it could be a car backfire, probably could even be somebody dropping a bunch of stuff in the street, I suppose. But a sharp, abrupt sound reaching a certain decibel level, presumably. And only after that is detected does the recording actually begin. The police materials that were made available made very quite clear that there has never once been a conversation recorded by this ShotSpotter technology. Yet, person after person after person paraded up to the microphone at this committee meeting, this public safety committee chaired by the illustrious Aya Al-Zoubi. And then again at a city council meeting on May 11th, many of the same people. And then again last night on May 18th, again repeating and repeating and repeating the same absolutely nonsensical misinformation. Now that would be okay because after all, it's a, public comment. Anybody can say what they want. But the fact that they were actually city councilors who were basically lapping it up like a cat laps up milk from a dish, that was really disturbing. One Councillor Zuzi actually was praising one of the greatest misinformers as such a wonderful person. And I've been going up to Cambridge City Hall paying attention for 4 decades, or almost 4 decades now, probably close to 4 decades. And honestly, I've kind of reached the bottom of the barrel now in terms of my respect for some of these city councilors. So that was quite the show there last night. I think maybe what I'm going to do here is shift over a little bit here just to display a little bit about this meeting here. Pardon my awkwardness in doing this. Here we go. Here it goes. Never mind Cambridge Civic Association, enough about that. But there was, it was, my commentary was that the charter right, this was an item that was made subject to the charter right, that it would bring out the usual suspects in need of repeatedly repeating their repetitive public commentary, which is exactly how it turned out to be. It was absolutely the same talking points repeated over and over and over. It's sort of false truth by the pound. Just keep on going and going and going. So anyway, that was one of the big items of the meeting. Maybe what I'll do here is I'll just sort of walk through a little bit of what else was going on at the meeting here, just for the sake of some completeness here. There was again, this is not the entire agenda, but these are just the things that I tend to find most interesting. One thing that's very interesting, sort of just to take a break from the ShotSpotter controversy for a moment here, was that the city got, I think, a pretty good deal financially for spending in the vicinity of about $800,000 to buy in the vicinity of 50 or so acres of land in the Cambridge watershed out in Lincoln. There have been past years where, whenever there was a something like this, people would come to do public comment and complain. I'm just going to sort of toggle back here and complain about the fact that why are we spending money in Lincoln? Like, it's the kind of people that turn on the faucet and just assume that, that this substance that pours from faucets simply comes from heaven for them. But there is a whole system. There's watershed protection, there's delivery through aqueducts to get to the out the fresh pond, drawing the water from fresh pond, processing it through the filtration plant, pumping it up to Payson Park in Belmont, so that it can be gravity fed into the system to not only provide drinking water but fire protection for the city of Cambridge. Anyway, the watershed protection is pretty damn important, and the fact that when in the past, thankfully not last night, that items such as that would actually come in, would actually lead to people saying, why are we throwing our money away in Lincoln? Or other people saying, why are we even maintaining our own water supply at all? Why don't we just go exclusively on MWRA, which we can do as a backup? And we may very well have to do that if the drought continues later this year. There's no way on earth, by the way, that MWRA would basically say, sure, we'd like you to be permanently on our water, because they've got some concerns about supply as well. So they very much appreciate the fact that Cambridge maintains its own water supply. And by the way, we appreciate it too, because the water that we get through our own methods is actually ends up the net cost of that is much, much cheaper than if we had been purchasing it from MWRA. We got to get rid of the water either way. So the sewer bill is actually like three times as expensive as the water bill. But that's essentially a fixed cost. So whether we were getting our water from the MWRA or from Fresh Pond and Hobbs and Stony Brook reservoirs, we'd still have to pay the same fee for the sewer costs anyway. So there's no getting around that. Anyway, I always appreciate seeing those sorts of things, because I think that's important. And again, I think some people in past years basically would have rather just turned Fresh Pond into a recreational facility rather than a water supply. Sort of moving on a little bit here, there was reports. There was both a report on social housing, as well as some appointments to a social housing task force. The appointments, by the way, included, I believe, three city councilors who are all major advocates of social housing. And again, just as I sort of toggle my way around here, we've got to really make up our mind for stuff. How do you want to do public housing? It just seems to me that the especially again, I'll say the word, this amongst the socialist crowd, their notion is that private property is just plain evil, and if they could have their way, nobody would own any private property. It would all be, quote, social housing. I'm always entertained a little bit by the words from the city manager and from the executive director of the or assistant city manager in charge of community development, currently Melissa Peters, where we keep talking about how we have to define social housing in the Cambridge context. I don't know quite what that definition will turn out to be. But I'll be right up front about this. As far as I'm concerned, you can call it social housing, you can call it inclusionary units, you can call it public housing, you can call it limited equity, this, that, or the other thing. But the thing is that if it's basically a product of government action and subsidy, and if it has a reduced, I mean, not just reduced, but de minimis tax revenue produced by these properties here. So therefore, the any social, any services that are consumed by the residents of such properties are paid by, for by people like me or the commercial sector in the city. To me, it's also just different euphemisms for public housing. And then the question, which nobody ever wants to address, is what is the appropriate level of subsidized housing for a city like Cambridge? My own personal view is that it should be sort of in the 15% of the housing units in the neck of the woods. But the activist crowd always wants to avoid answering that question because if they were to be truthful, they would probably have to say 50% or 100%, if they could have their way. But anyway, what happens with this, we'll see. I mean, there's a sort of a political element to this, to be sure. I think they certainly, if they wanted to try something, either as a pilot or whatever, they'd need a site. I think maybe the city, I'm speculating a bit here, have the old Buckingham Brown and Nichols property that was the city acquired. It's along Fresh Pond Parkway, may well be where they would try to do something. But who knows? Maybe they'll try and pack it into Central Square, where, because I know there are some activists who think that the only new housing that should come into Central Square is subsidized housing. And I personally believe that would be that would just destroy Central Square as a viable part of the city, if in fact it was basically just public housing. There already is a very high fraction of public housing in the area, as it is anyway. Anyway, so moving on a little bit here. Here we go. So that was one part of the meeting from last night here. Another thing, oh yes, the minor point really, but it was very nice to see that since the city council has not yet been able to come to some consensus about who should be the next city clerk in some permanent sense, that Paula Crane, who's been serving as interim city clerk, got another 6 months extension to that role. She's great. She's wonderful. And I'm, honestly, if it was up to me, I wish she would be the city clerk for at least the next 3 or more years. But I don't believe that's something she wants. But anyway, so she'll be around in that role while the city council sort of tries to work it out successfully or unsuccessfully. Anyway, getting back to what I think was some really sort of one of the most interesting but also frustrating and aggravating parts of the council meeting last night was this the matter that had come up at the previous meeting having to do with this order calling for the that there should be no more data collected by the ShotSpotter devices. Everything should be deleted. And later on in the order, though it's not written here in the summary, they basically just said to end it completely. Now, I thought there would be enough reason in the room. Actually, let me just step out of here. Enough reason in the room to, look at this rationally. Like, for example, the misinformation about the 82% of the activations of SpotShotter turned out to be false alarms. People make it, and then they'll say, see, it's only 18% accurate, is how they read it. And I thought, well, come on, put on your thinking caps, kids. The truth of the matter is, the reason why almost all activations of ShotSpotter aren't actually gunshots is because, thankfully, we don't have that many gunshot incidents in Cambridge. That's a good thing. You understand? That's a good thing. Yet that is what's being bastardized in this ridiculous narrative here to somehow justify the fact that this is ineffective technology. So there aren't that many activations, but there have been some where time was of the essence where it was very, very useful. Anyway, so they went through it all. People, had their say, and then in the end, the city council voted I think what the vote was 4 votes in favor. Excuse me. I thought there would be 5 votes to not discontinue. The city manager made it pretty clear this was a useful tool for the police, and that he was very much speaking in concert with what Pauline Wells, the interim, the acting police commissioner, said about this is useful for us and we would love to keep it. But in spite of the fact that the police commissioner said this is useful and the city manager backed her up, five city councilors said get rid of it. Now, whether that's an absolute obligation for the part on the part of the city manager because now it's city council policy to get rid of it, I can't say for sure, but somehow I imagine that it'll now get deactivated. Of course, the activists want them to basically make sure it's also it's thoroughly re physically removed as well, and rather than just deactivated. So the councilors who voted in support of this were predictably Aya Al-Zoubi, who would ban the police entirely if she had her way. Jeevan Sabrina Wheeler, who I believe has pretty much exactly the same philosophy. Sumbul Siddiqui, who is she's not nearly as upfront about her political tendencies. I think she tries to go in under the radar, but she's very much aligned with Al-Zoubi and Sabrina Wheeler. And then it was Patty Nolan and Mark McGovern. Now, they should know better. I don't know whether it's for political reasons. As I often like to say, they like to suck up to the DSA crowd. Because they are, after all, you don't, they are potential supporters for your political life. And you also don't like to necessarily have those buzzards circling around trying to ruin you either. So you basically cave to them. So I thought the rhetoric from Mr. McGovern was silly. And the pseudo facts that we typically hear from Councillor Nolan were as well, let's just say they were what we typically hear from Councillor Nolan. There were the others. There was one flat out vote no, and then it was just a lot of voting present, right? I believe that's how it went, right? I'm just sort of looking it up here a little bit as I go. Yeah, there were actually two people, Councilors Flaherty and Simmons, who voted no to the removal, and Burhan Azim and Kathy Zusi voted present. And I don't know really why a person would vote for present on this. It seems a little odd to me. I do find it kind of interesting that the one black counselor we have is Counselor Simmons. Basically says when I talk to the people in my neighborhood, she lives really very, very close to Washington Elms and Newtown Court. She makes it very, very clear that the people who actually lived around here, as she likes to say, people who look like me, very much appreciate the Cambridge Police Department, and they very much appreciate the fact that there's efforts being made to keep them safe. So when you have people who don't look like Councillor Simmons presenting themselves as the great grand wisdom of all black and brown people, saying that this is what's good for black and brown people, I find that to be incredibly insulting, to be quite honest. Actually, I think Councillor Simmons at the May 11th meeting had a rather used a couple of interesting, as she often does, uses some very interesting phrases. She refers to the people during public comment as performative allyism, meaning, honestly, people who could very well have gone to prep school pretending to be also concerned about people, their lessers, and saviorism of marginalized people. Anyway, in the end, the vote was taken to remove ShotSpotter, if that had been the only bit of ridiculousness at the council meeting, maybe I would have just laughed it all off, because I do, honestly, even when I see some absolute ridiculousness happening there, I at least try and find a little humor in it. You got to keep yourself entertained, right? So anyway, so that was a part of that meeting.